He doesn't sound like a nerd,
but the computers are still scared of him. Keeping your technology running smoothly, here's Benjamin Rockwell with Computer Talk Radio.
There's a ton in store for you on this, our 18th birthday of Computer Talk Radio. Let me go through all of the different things we're going to be covering. I've got a number of listener questions. Marcus, are we at the point where we don't have to buy a new PC every 3 years? David, why do I keep getting asked about push notifications and should I do it? Diana, niece's school issued a Chromebook and it's reportedly slow, so we'll do a deep dive into that one. Keith M. Cedor, he and I are going to talk about Gemini and Siri, the collaboration there, and our hopes with what's going on there. Mark is going to talk about the Anova Precision Chamber Vacuum Sealer, high-tech cooking stuff. On the scam series, the pre-refund trap, when the bad guys are offering you cash up front. Oh, yeah, that's kind of weird. And Steve Keske, how do different generations handle tech adoption? And Dr. Doreen Galley, identifying us to be us is one topic, and packaging tech revisited also. And I will cover the importance of the small business office or small home office internet router. All of that, of course, on this week's Computer Talk Radio. The website, computertalkradio.com, computertalkradio.com. The phone number, 888-NERD-888. That's 888-637-3888. Now, Satya Nadella, he is the CEO of Microsoft, and he was speaking at the World Economic Forum this past week. One of the biggest takeaways from, he did a 40-minute conversational encounter with the CEO of BlackRock. And the biggest takeaway from this was that AI has a potential to lose our interest. And that could be an issue. He covered the idea of social permission. And it has that right now, a position that AI right now can be just a toy. But in the future, it can't just be a toy. Instead, it has to change the outcomes of people, of communities, of industries, and even countries. If we are not gaining something meaningful from our encounter with AI, then everything we've done, all of this, is for naught. Billions upon billions of dollars spent with disruption in the chip world, the electric supply, water, heat, and more. And all of these things, it really rack up. But the benefits aren't coming for companies fast enough. Satya still appears to be excited, even while observing that there are potential problems with the idea that we haven't yet figured out. This is, of course, an evolving situation, and he is somebody who is really going to know. Again, he's the head of Microsoft right now. Now, Netflix had their quarterly earnings call this past week as well. The dollar details were a little bit better than what the numbers finance nerds thought, and that's a continuing trend for Netflix. All financial targets were met or exceeded, and that's good. 325 million global paid subscribers. Ad revenue was also up. Earnings per share were up. Revenue up. Nearly the only thing not up was the stock price. And this is all part of, it's being attributed to the fact that Netflix is still working to close down the Warner Brothers deal, which apparently is a very divisive situation in Hollywood with the customers and with pundits everywhere. Now, personally, I am fond of the idea of a larger library, so long as Netflix uses it to deliver us even more content across the board and not hide it away as a collector might secretly possess a Picasso painting and then never show it to anybody. To be fair, Netflix has already indicated that the separate feeds, the HBO Max and all of that, they're going to stay distinct for at least the foreseeable future. But how it evolves is going to be a key thing for us, the customers, the viewers, those that partake amongst this huge library that Netflix has the potential to access. Sam Altman, he is the CEO of and co-founder of OpenAI, which is the ChatGPT, basically. He released a notice in regards to OpenAI's ChatGPT age prediction. And this notice, it's written as an article, and it does offer a few bits of insight. The first in how they plan to protect users from content best suited for adults, but also in how their AI writing may be evolving. Now, the first part, they've followed the previously announced path of behavioral and account level signals, including how long an account has been open, when it's active, how it's used, and even a user's stated age or implied age. And there are ways to remove the flag on the account, and that flag is set to prevent access to a wide variety of content that's not suitable for youth. Great. And it's all fine and dandy. It's all spelled out on that article. The other item that I got out of it was a little bit more nuanced. It is the fact that the text appears to be skillfully crafted. And while it's removed a number of the markers of AI, like the M dash, that's that big, huge, long dash, and various predictable patterns, it still has some well-crafted sentences that just feel too long and too uniform and too perfect. I mean, we're talking, okay, yes, Sam Altman can afford to get some of the best writers out there, but something just feels mechanical about the writing. I couldn't place my finger on all of it, but there were certain nuances that said it's possibly written by AI, maybe massaged a little bit by hand here and there. And sure, it could be fully human written. But if not, this does give a new exciting insight and thoughts as to how far the next release of ChatGPT will handle delivering information. I was particularly excited by that. Now, this past week was also an interesting one for many people who know that they must follow their local weather. I spent 50 years of my life in Southern California, and you didn't have to follow the weather. Today is sunny and warm. Tomorrow will be more of the same. And the next day, and the next day, and the next day. I'm no longer there, but I did speak to people in the Northwest, the Midwest, the Northeast, near our nation's capital, and there was a recurring theme that there was an unpredictability in the reporting of what the weather was going to be like right now. This weekend, massively shifting numbers of, you know, a lot of people were reporting, it said it was going to be snow, and then it was going to be a lot of snow, and then somewhere near nothing, or somewhere near cataclysmic. It actually got to the point that the New York Times decided to call out, of all people, Apple Weather as being the culprit, but the reports were chaotic in multiple apps, and the chaos compared to others as well. I tinkered a little bit. I saw this happening. Everybody was talking about this early on, so I opened up Weather Underground, Apple Maps, and AccuWeather on a few different locations. Frankly, none of them ever agreed with themselves from 6 to 8 hours prior or later, let alone with each other. Of course, the reality is, behind the scenes, that weather is a series of educated and calculated guesses, and sometimes everyone guesses the same, and sometimes they don't. It's also subject to change based upon conditions that aren't readily obvious, which means it may not be accurate. Now, I've had some strange stories that I've seen over the past 18 years of running computer talk radio. I've seen some complete and total craziness in the news, but nothing like this. An Instagram user, who apparently is no longer online, made an announcement on December 31st that there was some secret NASA document called Project Anchor. In this document, supposedly, it laid out a goal for Earth to survive a 7-second gravitational anomaly on August 12. This sci-fi tale continued on ideas that seemed to come from the movie Deep Impact and other dystopian futuristic movies, except the impact is from two gravitational waves from black holes, blah, 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 blah. Look, it's not going to happen. Everything on this is pablum. But if you're going to be going to Iceland or you're interested in going to Spain or Russia, there will be a lunar eclipse that day. Coming up next, Marcus asks me, are we at the point where we don't have to buy a new PC every 3 years? That'll be here on Computer Talk Radio.
Let's talk about on and off.
You mean like light switches?
Yeah, the original user interface device.
And you were there, right?
Hey, I'm not that old.
Yeah, you are. So on and off.
Yeah, only with no humans doing it, like...
But you and I both have our computers on CyberPower UPS systems.
Yeah, so we have power, but there's another on and off.
Oh, right. Online and offline.
You got it. Meaning another UPS at the cable modem and VoIP phone and Wi-Fi router.
And even a low-cost standby UPS can handle those. Better, of course, if it has AVR.
Right, so it doesn't have to hit the battery just because the line voltage drops.
Maybe it's a good time to mention the promo that saves $10 to $15. Details are at the CyberPower website.
And maybe you could put it on your website?
Oh, that's already done at ComputerTalkRadio.com.
You know, on and off, you take really good care of your listeners.
Marcus had a question. Aren't we reaching a point where buying a new computer every few years isn't necessary anymore? And, really, it's a good question to explore, and that's what we're going to do next here in just a moment. But first, let's give out the website, ComputerTalkRadio.com, ComputerTalkRadio.com. That's how you can reach out to us. Scroll down to where it says contact us today, and I will get back to you. Even though I may not cover your information on the air, I am interested in answering all of your computer questions and your technology concerns, whatever they may be. So let's talk about this. And it is a good question. We should always reflect on this because there was a rhythm that was around for a long time. Buy a computer, use it for a few years, replace it. And there are a number of different factors that are coming along with this. Let's touch on one side of this first, and that is the software itself. And people have noticed that a lot of the things that they need to get done are actually doing quite well with the processing speed that they have. And that's a good thing. This is something for us to cheer on. When you think about it, yes, computers have been changing. They have been getting faster. But a lot of the processing speed has shifted in how it works. It used to be a simple number of how fast the processor was. And then we shifted into multi-core processing. Now we've got a series of multiple cores all doing different things. We have efficiency cores and we have performance cores. And then we've also moved into the whole thing about GPUs, graphical processing units. Let's then expand in a different direction. The processors aren't doubling in speed so much, but they are getting efficient. But the next direction I want to go in is that we have seen kind of this shift, and there's now a forced shift on us in regards to the memory pricing and the solid state drives and how they've become more expensive. That's going to change how a lot of the companies think about how they're putting out hardware, but also those that are putting out software. And that is going to create kind of a game changer along the way. And then we move into things like how the software is starting to stabilize. The software in our systems, there's no point in making, I don't know, a Microsoft Outlook have a need for gigs and gigs and gigs of RAM. It's simply email. Yes, there have been new features added. Yes, there is AI in there. But a lot of these things are no longer using the space that they used to. Even in gaming, a lot of the gaming concept has pushed us for a long time. A matter of, okay, I need to get a new computer because this game came out. Well, now there are so many games in so many different directions that is changing a lot of how we're dealing with what we want to do as far as buying new hardware or continuing on with what we have. Now we're more willing to give it a little bit extra time before we replace. I know gamers that used to buy a brand new system every year or two, and now I'm seeing gamers hang out for a while. My last system, I just replaced it just in the last couple of months, and it lasted me 6 years. And that was the longest I'd ever gone. That was what I used to do was every 3 years. I basically skipped a cycle. I was going to replace at the 3-year point when I originally bought it. I expected I would have to. And then I got to the 3-year point and I said, I can make it last another year. And then I said, okay, Windows 11 is kind of blah for me. I wasn't liking it, and I wasn't ready to make the big jump on my main system to that. Yes, I did Windows 11 on some other system, some other hardware around here. But we keep going down this road, and every year I kept on saying, I want Windows 12. I'll buy when Windows 12 is here. And I kept putting it off, and finally I said, there is one reason why I need to pay attention to this. There is one reason which is going to really make or break my decision on purchasing, and that is my hardware is 6 years old now. Now, let's think back to what it was 6 years ago, 5 years ago, 3 years ago. Back then, we were thinking about the replacement at 3 years, 4 years, maybe 5 years or 6 years. If you're really tight with money, you might go to 7. But the thing is, we were thinking about that kind of process, but also all of the retailers were doing this. And what they did was they adjusted the idea of mean time between failure. And they've long done this. Ages ago, we're talking back in the ages of DOS. The systems were built to last eons, not literal eons, but a matter of to last decades, true decades. And they realized we're overbuilding these. We're building these so solid that nobody will ever replace them because they're lasting, but we're also seeing a lot of people who are replacing them after 3, 4, 5 years. So where we used to have a mean time between failure of decades, we're now seeing mean time between failures that have come down. And in some components, when you combine all of this, when you throw this all together, you've got all of these components that are sitting in your system, and each of them has a mean time between failure of, let's say, 7 years. Well, that's the mean time, and I talk about this on a regular basis, a matter of it can fail sooner. It can fail later, but it can also fail sooner, and that's just one component. When you start talking about things like laptops, all of those systems were built and designed to last maybe 5 years. Maybe a little bit longer, but they did not see a value in going on out and going that extra mile for stuff that's going to wind up in a landfill in a matter of a decade. So, or 2 decades. They said, it doesn't need to last 2 decades. Everybody's going to get rid of it by then. It's going to be outdated. Moore's Law is going to really force a lot of people to refresh. It's kind of like making tires for your car that are going to last 200,000 miles. They're going to be really uncomfortable. That's a whole other story for another day. But if they were to make them last that long, most people don't hold on to their car for 200,000 miles. They hold on to it for about 100,000 miles. Then they get rid of it and they get another car because we do like novelty. So all of these different things along the way are going to break down. And we also have other factors in there like battery wear on laptops. And we've got aging displays. We get things like burn-in that's going to, you know, come along in here. We have different layers that are coming along, like a lot of people discovered, hey, I got this brand new system just before Windows 11 came out, and it won't run Windows 11 because it doesn't have the TPM processing. Well, yeah, that was a problem. So that is something that is going to probably force your hand. Don't count on this. Yes, things might be getting better, but really, all of this right now still looks like a point where we need to think about this on a regular basis. We still need to hold on to some extent to the idea of a regular replacement cycle, even though it may be a little bit painful right now due to the high cost of RAM and solid state drives. This is Benjamin Rockwell. You're listening to Computer Talk Radio. I'll be back with more in just a moment. Microcenter is where tomorrow's tech meets today's hands-on excitement. This is Benjamin Rockwell of Computer Talk Radio, and I've been shopping Microcenter for years because they always have what's next. Whether you're building a custom desktop, upgrading your laptop, or diving into smart home automation, Microcenter has the gear, the guidance, and the grit to get you there. From high-performance laptops and ultra-fast storage to 3D printers, robotics kits, and pro-grade monitors, it's all under one roof. Need help? Their in-store experts speak your language, whether that's HDMI, USB-C, or I just want it to work. With over 20 locations nationwide and microcenter.com open 24/7, you're never far from your next breakthrough. Whether you're a weekend tinkerer, a creative pro, or just tech curious, Microcenter is your launchpad. Visit microcenter.com today. That's Microcenter, built for what's next. Microcenter.com. The phone number 888-NERD-888. That's 888-6373-888. Feel free to leave a message for me if I don't answer. Of course, I am interested in answering your computer questions, your technology concerns, whatever they may be. Keith McDonald joins me now, and I am going to do one thing here. I'm going to note that when you told me about this just a minute ago, that it was an actual announcement, I realized I've been reporting, I've been doing something we don't do normally, and that is reporting rumor as fact. But
we call that engaging in speculative fiction.
Yes, exactly. So let's do the deep dive into this whole Gemini Siri whole workings
partnership.
Yes, there you go,
Benjamin. I am beyond excited about this on a number of fronts, not the least of which is that Apple has been promising us a newer, bigger, better, more enhanced, and at the end of the day, bottom line, smarter Siri.
They've only been promising that for a few weeks, maybe a couple months.
2023 came and went, nothing. Yeah. 2024 came and went. 2025 came and went. And here we are at the very beginning of 2026, and finally, an announcement that solidifies the work that has been done in this realm. Apple does what Apple does when they can't do it themselves. They outsource it, whether it's buying another company or making their own chips, they'll do something to finally fill in a gap. They may take a while to do it, but they do it. And what's neat for me is I have finally started playing around, for lack of a better term, only because I don't have a cohesive strategy or any accomplishable goals I'm looking to do with AI. So I've played around with Microsoft Copilot and, you know, again, Siri, dumb as a box of hammers, nothing you can do there. And I was also given some guidance that I should check out Google's Gemini.
Yeah.
And, oh, man, was I happy. I was interested in seeing what it could do as far as image creation goes. Mm-hmm. And Microsoft Copilot had a concept, couldn't implement on it at all. I mean, well, I asked it to draw some Star Trek pictures, and what it came up with was like something straight out of the 1950s. It was like Star Trek meets Buck Rogers and Flash Gordon of the 40s and 50s. Nothing what I was looking for. Fast forward to just about a week ago, I decided to do a fun little experiment with AI. Well, again, only because I don't have much to do with it yet. And for our other podcast, the Just Pour the Milk podcast, I decided to make some really cool AI pictures, cartoon characters, Pixar-like pictures, and even a really cool, realistic one of the four of us, including my favorite host, Benjamin Rockwell, as the cereal foil.
Yeah,
they are hilarious.
I don't know if hilarious really counts, but go on.
But compared to Microsoft Copilot, Gemini was, I won't say knocking them out of the park, but Gemini was hitting ground rule doubles and triples all the way. And when I got a picture that I think looked a little bit like you and a picture that looked a little bit like Christina, couldn't figure out what to do with me and Steven. I actually uploaded photos of me and Steven, and it actually produced a cartoon image that wasn't too far off.
Okay.
And we've actually published these on the Just Pour the Milk Instagram. So anybody wants to check them out, they're free to see. But what's really fun is that now Apple basically threw their hands in the air and said, you know what? We got nothing. Let's partner with somebody who's doing it well. And I mean, why do you think Apple pays millions of dollars a year, or maybe even billions at this point, to Google? I'm sorry, let me reverse that. Google pays billions of dollars a year to Apple to be the default search engine. And Apple is happy to put it there because they want to be known as having a quality product. And if they're happy to have their default browser or the default search engine be Google, they're going to do it. And it's not just for the money. Google gives good answers. And so what I've seen with Gemini so far, just tooling around. Well, I will say,
as much as you're touting Gemini, I have used Gemini and Copilot and ChatGPT and Claude and Apple Intelligence, which I rank Apple Intelligence as the worst of the bunch.
Apple Intelligence is a joke.
It's better than Siri, but that's like saying liver is better than liver and onions.
Image Playground in Apple Intelligence is good for, I'd like a picture of a candy cane and a marshmallow. It gives you a cartoon version of that.
It's
ridiculous.
An introduction. It's a basic start into.
It's what you give a child.
Capabilities. Yes, exactly. And I am not thrilled with it.
And this is coming from an Apple proponent.
But I will tell you right now, amongst the group, I would say I am liking Copilot the best, but
Tell me why you like it the best.
So for text, it does a lot better. It gets a better feel. I will tell you that the imagery, it does. There are a couple of things. You have to get the prompt right the first time.
Okay.
And you have to be far more descriptive and directive about what you want. And I don't know what you were using for your Gemini prompt and how it arrived so quickly for you, but that's been my experience there.
Well, what's interesting for me, Benjamin, is the fact that I feel I am being educated on how to prompt an AI to get the results you're looking for it to generate.
Yes, yes.
And with each successive attempt, you realize, you know, it's like telling a robot, make a peanut butter and jelly sandwich. And it's like, oh, put the peanut butter on the jelly, and it puts the jar of jelly and the jar of peanut butter on the closed loaf of bread without any other instructions.
There's some weird stuff that's always going to pop up. As for now, this is Benjamin Rockwell.
And I'm Keith M. Seedorf.
You're listening to Computer Talk Radio. I'll be back with more in just a moment.
Hi, this is Benjamin Rockwell. Most of us use digital cameras nowadays, but what do we do with those old pictures and slides in the back of the closet? Well, let me tell you about Legacy Digital Productions. They specialize in taking your old memories on film, videotape, and slides and digitizing them to DVDs. If you have boxes of old slides, then you know they fade more and more each year. Let Legacy Digital scan them for you and stop the aging process dead in its tracks. You'll get beautiful 10-megapixel digital files, color-corrected and ready for printing. All this is done faster and cheaper than buying a film scanner and doing it yourself. Your files are then burned onto gold archival DVD discs where they will last for generations. Call right now, mention my name, Benjamin Rockwell, and receive a 30% discount on your order. Call toll-free 1-866-2-LEGACY. That's 1-866-2-LEGACY. And tell them Benjamin sent you. Your memories are priceless, so call 866-2-LEGACY now.
Mark Brownstein's in for Marty Winston this week, and one of the things that I really do enjoy, you appear to be very much into food, and food is an important thing, but you've gotten into a number of different directions, a number of different conversations you and I have had off the air.
Oh, yeah.
But this one is really exciting to me, because I have done some of the stuff with edge sealing. And you've got this new approach to things. I'm stealing your thunder. Go ahead, take it away.
Okay, no, it's not a new approach. It's an old approach. They've been doing this in professional kitchens for years. I don't know if you watch Iron Chef or any of these other cooking shows. They take these things, they stick them in the chamber vacuum sealers. They suck the air out. They can marinate meats. They can do all kinds of things. I've had chamber vacuum sealer envy for quite some time. Been wanting one. I got one a few years ago, and it was just way too big. I found this one from Anova. I think it's called the chamber vacuum sealer, and it changes the game.
The precision chamber vacuum sealer. Yeah.
Precision chamber vacuum sealer. Okay. So what it does, you can put liquids into the bag and not worry about, like, an edge sealer where you have to stop it before it sucks the liquid in out of the bag and messes itself up. This one is designed so you can put liquids in the bag and then seal the bag. And the way it works is it has a vacuum. It takes the whole vacuum out of the chamber, takes out all the air, and then seals the bag. And then lets the air back in slowly, and what you wind up is a very tight package. It's sealed. Okay. The liquid goes nowhere, and it's flat. So if you want, you can take soup or whatever liquid you've got, freeze it, and you've got these flat little packets instead of things that are amorphous and take up a whole lot of space in the freezer.
Yeah,
I've been doing that with some stuff I got from Trader Joe. I'm using it over and over again. I cut the bag open. I take some of it out. I vacuum pack it again, seal it. And I've been doing it for 3 or 4 days with one package of food. So you can do that. And it also does things like infuse foods. They've got recipes for making your own limoncello, where you take it with some vodka, you take some orange peel or lemon peel, you set it to infuse and couple minutes later, you've got the stuff ready to add some simple syrup to. You got vodka. You got limoncello.
Okay.
You can pickle things. You take the pickling stuff you want, whatever produce you put in it, pickling liquid, and it will pickle pickle whatever it is you're using. This, I'm sure, can also marinate things. You put the marinade in, put the meat or whatever you want to marinate it, suck the air out of it, seal it up, and it will marinate much more quickly than if you stick it in a pot or something and let it sit there and steep.
It looks like it's about the size of a small toaster oven. So that's actually that's actually kind of a good size for the kitchen these days.
Yeah, it's not real big. It's not like these big 50-pound vacuums like they have in kitchens. There are advantages of that. It is about the size, about 30 inches wide. It's not tiny, but it fits under a counter. Mm-hmm. And it's attractive. It's not something you'd want to be looking. It's not ugly. It's not unattractive. Looks like high-tech something or other.
Yeah.
And the chamber is not as big as some of the other vacuums. But the problem with the other vacuums is there is so much space inside them. And I learned this just recently, that you have to put other things in there to mm-hmm. fill up some of the space, or it takes forever to get a vacuum.
Yeah.
So, but this one's small, so it can.
Yeah. So what is, if you were going to say, what's probably your most favorite thing that you've done with it so far that you haven't mentioned yet?
Just to be able to keep resealing things, I think, is what I've done. What I've done lately is, you know, with one package of food, I was able to use it 3 or 4 times because I can use it and then seal it. One of the things I'm doing, I'm buying cookie dough ready to go.
Yeah.
6 little cubes. I'm buying, they come in 12 in a pack. I make 6. I vacuum seal the other 6, and I can cook them later.
Okay. All right. So
it's a way to extend a pack of 12 into 2 packs of 6, because my wife and I don't need 6 cookies at a time. We have 3, and then we have 3. The other 6 are still packed away, ready to go. So that is probably my favorite thing yet with this. I'm sure there's going to be other things. I'll probably making some infused oils, you know, a little garlic and some olive oil in a few seconds, and I've got infused garlic oil.
Sure.
So things that I'm looking forward to doing. If we drank more, I'd probably infuse some liqueur, but I'm going to make up some simple syrup and use some of my lemon peel, because I've got a lemon tree with all kinds of lemons on it.
Yeah.
And infuse some simple syrup and then pour that into carbonated water and make myself some tasty drinks.
Yeah. Yeah. And you had told me the ability to extract the oils out of things like orange peel or lemon peel and that.
Yeah.
That's an exciting thing as well. There's a lot of things that you can do with the kitchen, and this is some serious high tech. It looks like it normally runs $374. At the time we're recording, it's $280, which is a great price. That's Anova. This is Benjamin Rockwell. That's Mark Brownstein. You're listening to Computer Talk Radio. I'll be back with more in just a moment. Years ago, I found a web hosting company that fit my needs as a computer nerd, as a radio show host, and just a normal person. Recently, though, it was clear to me that it was time to upgrade, but I had a choice between my old plan and the new one at 7 times the cost. It was that awkward point where I could choose between a sip of water or being dunked in a pool. I searched around, comparing the many options for someone like me. After searching around for 3 weeks, there it was, SiteGround. In proper fashion, I tested their customer service, their knowledge, and their willingness to do things the right way. The SiteGround salesman made sure that I didn't overbuy and get a 50-gallon bucket when a 32-ounce soda would do. These guys know WordPress, Joomla, and regular standard websites. These guys at SiteGround are awesome. SiteGround.com. 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 the bad guys are out to get us. They're out to get you, me, and everybody they can. And every so often, these bad guys, the scammers, rediscover an old trick. They shine it up and act like, ooh, hey, we've invented fire. And this one is something that has been around for a long time. I call it the pre-refund trap. It starts with this message. Oh, you're owed money. Now, it can be a rebate, a refund, a reimbursement, a credit, whatever it is. It sounds like a free dessert after a long meal. And here's the clever part. They're not asking you to pay anything. They're offering to give you money. Here's money that you weren't expecting. This flips the psychology. Suddenly, you're not on the edge of your seat. You're not on guard. You're curious. The email, the text, the phone call, it sounds official. It looks official. And it hopefully is going to pass that squint test. Logos, formatting, tone, it all feels corporate. But there's something a little off. Like someone wearing a suit that's two sizes too big. They'll say something like, we've attempted to process your refund, but your preferred payment method couldn't be verified. And this is a hook. They want you to confirm where to send the money. That means, what are you giving them? You're going to give them your name, your bank info, your login, your card details, all kinds of different details that they don't deserve. And once you do this, once they have this personal information, the refund disappears, as well as your money. It walks out the back door with a scammer just whistling away. Woohoo! And look, this is something that the really big thing for you to do is to really think things through, to pause. Your correct response should always be not to hand over your wallet to the bad guys. Like, refunds don't require verification from you. You need to always remember this. If a company owes you money, they already know who you are. They know how to reach you. They can send you a check. They can do whatever it is to give you that refund. Ironically, I've got a credit card that I keep overpaying, and they keep sending me a check instead of just shifting the account money out of that credit card into the bank account. They just send me a check, and I keep running into this. Look, they know how to take care of you. If you're not sure about what's going on, if you aren't really clear on this, you can go directly to the company's website. Don't use the link in the message. Don't go to, oh, hey, look, they've got a handy link here. You can go to your own bank and you can check the account there. You've got full control here. Scammers know that free money is a phrase that's going to make your brain just take a coffee break. Stay sharp, stay skeptical, and remember, if anybody wants to give you money, they don't need your bank password to do it. This is Benjamin Rockwell. You're listening to Computer Talk Radio.
Coming up next is a really funny guy. You all know him. Let's give it up for Alonzo Bowden. Alonzo!
So my uncle calls and he says he's dizzy and he's losing his balance. I'm like, Unc, you want me to take you to a doctor? He's like, no, I'm going to look up the symptoms. I said, your symptoms are you're dizzy and you're losing your balance. So he said, I can't get on the internet because my arm is numb. I said, well, use your good arm and dial 911. Stroke's no joke. If you or someone you love is showing symptoms of stroke, don't call family. Don't dial a friend. Don't wait, because it might be too late. Dial 911. Time lost is brain lost. Seriously, dial 911.
Learn all the symptoms of a stroke at strokesnojoke.org. That's strokesnojoke.org. A public service announcement brought to you by the American Stroke Association and the Ad Council.
Thank you.
gigabyte, kilobyte, terabyte, megabyte, all this stuff makes my brain megahertz. Translating technobabble to English, your translation expert, Benjamin Rockwell, is here with Computer Talk Radio.
We are halfway through this week's Computer Talk Radio. Of course, the website, computertalkradio.com, computertalkradio.com. That is a great resource for you if you want to see, the podcast, you want to see the news items, you want to contact us. And if you want to do that, scroll down where it says contact us today. And of course, I will get back to you with answers to your computer questions and your technology concerns. I also have the phone number of 888-NERD. 888. That's 888-6373-888. And if I don't answer, that's okay. Leave a message. That number is available all the time. Steve Keske joins me now, and Steve has been around for a long time in tech. He retired from tech a number of years ago, but you spent so long doing it and seeing the impacts across
many platforms.
Yeah, exactly. So I want to dive into kind of a general field of how people have done tech adoption across the various generations, and whether we're talking about the greatest generation and the boomers, the Gen Z, Gen Y, millennials, and
whatever,
all of that, or you're just talking about general age adoption, it's an interesting area to explore. I know for myself that I am a very, very early digital native. My first computer was when I was somewhere around 12 or 13 years old, and it was really exciting, and I picked it up and I learned it, and I will sit down in front of brand new technology items and I pick them up, even if they are more complex interfaces. And I think a lot of youth these days, they pick that up because they're steeped in technology from the age of 5 to 7 or even younger, and they just learn how to pick it up easy.
Well, it technology.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, when you have to, here's a little bit of history to go with all this because it's really impacts. Because my parents, a TV set was non-existent.
Yes.
In my generation, a TV set was, whoa, you got a TV set. That's, wow, you're really up there with technology. Nowadays, if you don't have an iPad or an iPhone, a lot of kids say, well, geez, how come you don't?
Are you a Luddite? Are you stuck back in the 17th century? Yeah, of course.
And that's the progress. It's what's going on in society basically is built by what technology is doing for society in youth. Then you get into people that are working with it. And then you get the seniors who are saying, do I really need it?
And yet when they see that and they use it, they do find how much they enjoy it.
Oh, that's true. And a lot, but there's still a lot of, it's that old adage. If it wasn't there for my father and it was good enough for him not to have it, then why should I?
Yes, I have seen that kind of approach. I remember there have been a few different people that I've encouraged over the years to take on smartphones.
Yeah.
Or various other things, get into computing in general.
Yep.
And they were very reluctant at first. They were like, no, I've lived my whole life without it. Why do I need something like that now? And I wasn't mocking your voice. I know you've been in tech that whole time. But I think that you're very right on that. And there is a certain level of reluctance.
And the reluctance comes from their two different angles. One is, do I really need it? And two, if I really use it, is it going to harm me?
Yes.
And that's the other this side of the coin. Most seniors say, hey, I hear all about spam. I hear all about people that are hacking my phone or hacking phones and hacking computers. Why do I want to risk my information with all that?
Sure.
Of course, they don't realize you got a bank account, you're at risk. You know?
Yeah.
That's.
I would throw in one more item that you didn't touch on, and that is that some of them have an unspoken, unexpressed fear that they will get some of this high-tech stuff, and they will try to go forward and use it, and they will stumble and fall, and they don't want. Some of them don't want to ask for help. Some of them are afraid that they're going to break it. Some of them are afraid of whatever it is out there.
Oh, yeah. It's the whole complex attitude psychologically of, do I want to go into something I don't know anything about without being taught? And who's going to teach me? Because I don't know.
So this is something that's going to be a very interesting exploration off of this. You dove into a smartphone. You had, prior to that, you had flip phones and whatnot, yep. But you dove into a smartphone,
yep.
Being legally blind.
Yep.
You could see a little bit of this stuff and kind of move forward through. And yet, where do you sit with that smartphone now?
In my pocket.
Well, I didn't mean literally, physically, yeah. Where it is. But
I use probably the basics of the iPhone. I don't get into using a lot of apps. I don't get into using a lot of other stuff.
But you don't have to, though.
No.
You do, and you do realize that. I know from our past discussions. But you do use it.
Yep.
As I understand, for checking out facts online and getting information in regards to whatever knowledge whim that you're trying to seek out something, seek out answers.
Well, the biggest thing is every morning I get up and what do? I check for the weather.
Yes. And you don't have to.
I don't have to turn on a TV or wait for a weather report on some channel or something. I say, hey, you know, tell me, what is the temperature?
All right. I can tell you that.
Yeah. And it's going to rain today, or it's going to be hot and sunny, or whatever variation on the weather. It's going to give you that information.
Sure.
And that is, for some people, that's just a simple game changer.
Yeah.
But you can ask for directions to places. You can ask, who is in this movie, or things like that. And that is something that people don't realize. We have that ability to just move a little bit further forward with just that tool that's right by your side.
Yep. That comes out working really good at times, too, especially when you're asking, oh, hey, I know this actor and I know that actress. Is there any, they have the same last name. Is there any relationship between these two?
Okay. All right. So this is something that I think seniors who have been hesitant should feel free to chase ahead further. I do know that we have seniors these days that are taking up computer programming when the first computer they owned was only about 10 years ago. And others use it for various hobbies.
Yeah. And that's all in the name of the game, as they say.
Yeah, it's leveraging technology to better your life. It's just taking whatever is there and available. And you may find along the way, hey, I do like the idea of being able to look up facts while I'm out and about around the world or whatever. I like the idea of having this mapping ability. Oh, I love the idea of always being able to reach out to my kids, grandkids, whoever it is, and just check in, even though I may be on the road. This is Benjamin Rockwell. That's Steve Kesky. You're listening to Computer Talk Radio. I'll be back with more in just a moment. You have a couple of those new carbon open frame racks from CyberPower, right?
Yeah, I love them. I configured a 25U to 40 inches deep, about twice as deep as a regular rack, and put more than a dozen peripherals in it.
You know, I saw your article about it. I can't believe it's not clutter.
And my 45U carbon rack, that's also 40 inches deep, will hold a ton of networking and control systems, the network video recorder.
Holy screwdriver, rack man!
You're getting one of their gorgeous enclosed racks soon.
Oh yeah, the 24U. Bigger than their wall mount carbon racks, but smaller than their tall boy.
Did you see what's happening with carbon on the CyberPower website?
Oh yeah, the promo, 10% off all their racks and rack accessories through the end of September. I put a link up at computertalkradio.com. computertalkradio.com. The website, computertalkradio.com, computertalkradio.com. That's how you can reach out to us. Scroll down to where it says contact us today, and I will get back to you with answers to your computer questions and your technology concerns, whatever they may be. Dr. Doreen Galley joins me now. And Doreen, you've got a couple of new TBW Whisper reports. Tell me about these.
Absolutely. So the first one is a fully public with the video and everything. And it's TBW 2085. If someone's looking for it, remember it's the URL / TBW 2085. And it's called What Are the Latest Advancements in Decentralized Identity and Verifiable Credentials?
That is that's a distinct mouthful. You want to unpack that for the listeners?
I was thinking you were going to say that. So identity is very interesting. It's a part of security.
Yeah.
Just like in real life, right? You go to the airport. What do? You pull out your real ID. You say, this is who I am, right? In electronics and technology, it's done electronically. But the thing is, every time you go to a new company, a new website, that company tries to figure out who you are within them. And it's completely related, unrelated to anything else, right? Mm-hmm. Everyone has their own identity system. There are government identity systems, but when you go government, technically it's not decentralized because the government's one place. But the example given at Identiverse was the UK government. But the point was, is that if you have this universal thing on your phone and when you do it, it's like, okay, I really know who they are.
Yeah, right? Yeah.
But how is this stuff advancing? Right. And one of the interesting things is the first one. Have you ever heard of passwordless?
Yes.
Okay. But a lot of listeners might not.
Yeah. Go ahead and explain that one out. Yes.
And so one of the difficulties with passwordless or passwords is within any system, there's not just people, there's applications, there's data, there's all these other things, these non-human identities that need to verify and know who they are. Right. But how does a application deliver a password to authenticate itself to get permission to go and execute anything? The only way to do that would be to store it somewhere. And now you have a written down password in a system that gives it authority to go do something. To make a long story short, that does not work in non-human identities at all.
Yes, right?
You want this password list where it's a different through a token or one of the other options is a real good solution. One of the other things that they're trying to do to increase credentials, because credential stealing is a big thing, right? If I steal your ID, they may not match my picture to it, and they might not realize that I'm not Benjamin. And they might just let me in because I have a valid ID.
Yeah. So
one of the things you can do with electronic credentials is it's a valid credential, but it's only for an hour. Mm-hmm. So even if someone stole it, there's only so much damage that can be done. Sometimes they refer to that as limiting the blast radius.
Yes, exactly.
Of any problem, which in cybersecurity is always really, really, really big. And so it's interesting because they're doing all of these things to try to make our systems more secure, including where I verify who you are and you get, you know, at TSA and they're like, okay, this is really Benjamin. At the same place they let you through a gate. It doesn't have to be at the same place. Verifying who you are can be separated from the actual authorization. So that's separating authentication from authorization. When you tie them in too closely, sometimes they can get easier compromise.
Mm-hmm,
if you have a separate, okay, I know who they are. Okay, now that we know who they are, can we do it? They also do different things, which we do in life, chaining identity, right? Marty knows me, he knows you, he introduces me to you, right?
Yes,
because you know him, he knows you. And so chaining identities, you know, Marty knows who Benjamin is, Benjamin knows who Paul is, Paul knows who Doreen is. And so therefore, Doreen is who she really is because all these people in the chain know each other and everyone was verified along the way.
So
these are some of the fun things that they're doing in addition to using standards. Standards are always really good. you can't ignore standards. But it's kind of interesting. I had some people quoted in it because, as you know, all the WISP reports, we actually interview people at the conference. This was done at Identiverse, which is held here in Vegas every year. Oh, yeah. We can't wait again this year for it. It's going to be fantastic. But we had you've heard of GitGuardian. We had someone from a GitGuardian, Apano, Keyless, and Simio, and Panini are the different companies that are quoted. And just a reminder, we are not paid for play. These are people that had technology in the space. So, you know, I walked up to them and said, hey, I have a feeling you have an opinion on this. And I always get one or two answers. Right.
Sure.
They either say, absolutely, I have an opinion on this, or can't wait to read it. That's a really good question. And it's funny because sometimes you could tell by the respect when they say no, that it's a really good question.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
That's really exciting. We had one drop to our members area this week as well, which is our private area on YouTube. This one we researched at PAC Expo.
Okay.
So PAC Expo is that huge packaging robotics event for the back end of where you put things in boxes and put things in packaging and all automation and machinery. A great, great event. This one is about the biggest tech blind spots for chief information officers.
Okay.
And the difficulty is there's something called OT-IT integration. Right.
Oh, okay. Oh, yeah. I can see where this is going to go real crazy. Yes.
Yeah.
You're right.
So for those not familiar, right, information technology is who you generally think of as the technologist in a company. We do the fintech software. You know, we make sure your website's working. We make sure your payroll goes out. All those transactional systems, right? If your email goes down, you actually do not have a financial consequence to it, believe it or not.
Right.
I know this because it happened to me once and the business tried to find a financial consequence and they could not. And they really tried. It was during a patch that was released during Black Hat, got exploited on top of it. Everyone went down. You know, we did great. We rolled out the patches early, but our email went down and you could not officially, because they could call the business and still place the order.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right. And that's true of most IT systems. Operations tech, very different.
Yeah.
Very, very different. They're in robot, right? They need a technology dealing with robots, machinery, manufacturing, packaging. So even a small company, you have a small IT shop running in the front of your shop, suddenly you put in some automation. That technology is different than 90%+ of the technology that most people in IT are used to dealing with. And I say 90%.
Yes.
Do you know what the overlap is? networking.
Yeah, okay.
Networking also
fair
has
enough.
Sensor data and deals with physical machines.
Yeah.
So security and networking are the only people within IT that have any inclination of how to deal with sensor data. But it's not just that, right? When a machine goes down in a Ford manufacturing facility, the implications to the business have large decimals. And it's by the minute.
Yes.
There's a reason why Six Sigma came out of operations technology, right? Mm-hmm. Because their errors and their downtimes are always measured in millions and lives. It's not uncommon, right? Where it could cost someone their life as well. Like the machines in a hospital, those are OT.
Yes, indeed.
Right? All those machines are OT. And so this document kind of dives in and says, okay, you're doing something, you're deploying this new technology. In this case, it's packaging robots, but the research applies to anyone doing an OT-IT integration, right? Mm-hmm. The first thing they brought up is, we weren't invited to the meeting. This came up from Universal Robots, and they're like, yeah, they're going to deploy a robot. And we're like, where's your IT team? You're trying to have a business impact, and I know you will, but it doesn't make it all the way to the financial system. Where's your data person for the company?
And yeah, I'll give it a talk,
If you're thinking about putting in these robots, you got to make sure you talk to everyone. And so there's this different culture, lack of understanding, and sometimes they're not even in the room with OT and IT, and that doesn't work for the business.
Definitely.
So focus is on that.
What's the Whisper report on that second one?
That is 2102, and it's in the members area for our YouTube, at TBW Advisors. T for technical, B for business, and W for whispers.
This is Benjamin Rockwell.
Dr. Doreen Kelly.
You're listening to Computer Talk Radio. I'll be back with more in just a moment. MicroCenter is where tomorrow's tech meets today's hands-on excitement. This is Benjamin Rockwell of Computer Talk Radio, and I've been shopping MicroCenter for years because they always have what's next. Whether you're building a custom desktop, upgrading your laptop, or diving into smart home automation, MicroCenter has the gear, the guidance, and the grit to get you there. From high-performance laptops and ultra-fast storage to 3D printers, robotics kits, and pro-grade monitors, it's all under one roof. Need help? Their in-store experts speak your language, whether that's HDMI, USB-C, or I just want it to work. With over 20 locations nationwide and microcenter.com open 24/7, you're never far from your next breakthrough. Whether you're a weekend tinkerer, a creative pro, or just tech curious, MicroCenter is your launchpad. Visit microcenter.com today. That's MicroCenter, built for what's next. MicroCenter.com. Diana's question. My niece asked why her school Chromebook feels so slow, even though it's brand new. Diana's question came in at ComputerTalkRadio.com. You can do it as well. Scroll down to where it says contact us today, and I will get back to you with answers to your computer questions and your technology concerns. And in this case, the school Chromebook, even though it's brand new, and I will start off with, it may not be brand new. It may be a reissue. It may be one that is from a few years old. And it may also be a situation where the school went out and they bought 100 of these or 200 or whatever with the minimal funds that they had. And while they got a Chromebook, they didn't get the best of horsepower processor or the best of memory, RAM. And this is something that's an additional concern across Chromebooks. So Chromebooks are built around a minimalist philosophy. They're meant to be affordable. They're meant to be secure, and they're meant to be easy to manage. This all really works well in school settings. The school doesn't want to go on out and buy a bunch of Alienware laptops. They want to buy a bunch of devices that can meet minimal requirements. And one of those requirements, again, is driving the price down. And across the brands, however you want to call it, most of the Chromebooks are still utilizing entry-level processors. They would not run Windows, no matter how hard you tried. They're utilizing a lot less RAM than our Windows systems. So this does become great for basic tasks like browsing, for writing, for doing video calls and things like that. But it's not going to be something that's amazing. They rely heavily on the cloud as well. So we're talking Google Docs and Google Drive, and there's various apps that they might be using in the classroom that are going to be far more specific, but they're going to be tailored and targeted for the school usage. So they don't need a lot of local storage or processing power, but that trade-off keeps the cost low. You sense a recurring theme here, right? It also keeps maintenance simple because they've got a few hundred of these, and if one of them drops, they just grab another one from the shelf, they hand it out, and you log in, and all of the information is still there. But this comes with that trade-off. Performance will feel sluggish, especially under pressure. There are some tips and tricks along the way. If your niece has multiple tabs open, and she's streaming video and running background extensions or whatever else, even a new Chromebook can crawl to a halt very quickly. Additionally, I'm still going to focus in on that school situation. You know, some school devices are locked down and they're overloaded. They've got all kinds of blocking so that kids don't wind up on sites they're not supposed to. They've got monitoring tools on them, and they're constantly pushing out updates. Now, who pushes out these updates? Well, the IT department for the school district. And are they utilizing these Chromebooks to do their work? Probably not. Are they going through and using the same applications as the youth are? No, I'm guessing not. They will check. They'll make sanity checks. Hey, do we still get to load this app? Yeah, it took a little bit longer than I expected, but yeah, that's fine. It's only just a second or two longer. Now, all of these controls, all of these different things for the IT department are important in regards to safety and compliance, but they add in overhead, especially if the device is checking in with the school servers, it's running background filters, it's doing all kinds of different things. And some of the schools will preload a number of different extensions and apps, and this can eat up memory. It can slow things down. The updates, too, when they're doing this, they're doing these updates timed for when kids are connected. What happens when the kid is done, the youth is done with their school day? They close down the system and it's off, and they can't push updates overnight. So what happens? Those updates come out during the first hour or two that in Diana's case, her niece, but any student logs in, and that can bog down performance. It's utilizing that same internet pipe that the student is using to connect up, and that doesn't matter whether it's at home or within the school. And also, students can't usually uninstall things. They can't tweak much. So they're really stuck with whatever the school is configured, even if it's not optimized. There are some things. I already mentioned keep tabs to a minimum. I mean, Chromebooks struggle when too many are open at once. Restarting is a key thing that can help clear memory. It can apply updates cleanly. And I will tell you, many students just leave those Chromebooks just running. It's either running or it's in sleep mode. And it may be weeks between restarts. And this is a great tip to give to her, to say, hey, maybe this will help it run better. If the school allows it, you might look through unused extensions or apps apps that may be on there that might help free up the resources and improve responsiveness. You can also consider using offline mode for Google Docs and Google Drive. That can reduce lag when the Wi-Fi is spotty, which is common in crowded classrooms. Ultimately, though, all the way along, the limitations are structural. The Chromebooks aren't built for speed. They're built for scale. They're built for getting from point A to point B. Not necessarily quickly. This isn't a matter of going down the highway at 80 miles an hour or whatever the speed limit is. It's going to function at 45 miles an hour on side streets. And in this whole trade-off between speed and scale, performance is usually going to take a back seat to all of that. This is Benjamin Rockwell. You're listening to Computer Talk Radio. I'll be back with more in just a moment.
Hey guys, this is Benny Rockwell. Most of us use video cameras nowadays, but what about those old movie films in the back of your closet? Well, let me tell you about Legacy Digital Productions. They specialize in taking your old memories on film, videotape, and slides and digitizing them to DVDs. Imagine grandpa's old 8mm and 16mm films that are just sitting in a box getting old and fading away. Legacy Digital will clean and recondition those films, capture them digitally frame by frame, and then produce beautiful DVDs of your precious memories on long-lasting archive-quality discs. They don't use a projector, and your films can't be damaged in the process, the best available for families like yours. The final results are gorgeous. What better way to preserve those precious memories for future generations? Call right now, mention my name, Benny Rockwell, and receive a 30% discount on your order. Call toll-free 1-866-2-LEGACY. That's 1-866-2-LEGACY, 1-866-253-4229. And tell them Benny sent you. Your memories are priceless, so call 866-2-LEGACY now.
This is Benjamin Rockwell, and now it's time to get down to business. This is where we talk about the tech that quietly keeps your office, or in this case, your home office, your small business, running day after day. And I want to talk about the router. And we think of this router. It's that little box in the corner with a blinking light. It links us to the internet, and it's easy to forget about it until the internet drops in the middle of a video call, and then suddenly it's the most important device in the building. In a home office or a small business, the router isn't just providing Wi-Fi. It's the front door to your digital world. It decides the information that gets in, the information that stays out, and how everything inside the office communicates. And we have this in big offices, in big corporations. They've got a number of these different items that are serving the same thing. They're broken up into a lot of different devices. But when we're in the small office or home office, it does a lot of stuff all at once. The router handles traffic, internet traffic, all of the digital bits and bytes that are going across the internet, your local network, like a little miniature air traffic controller. Every device, every request, every packet gets routed to the right place, hopefully without collisions. And when it works, you never notice this. And when it doesn't, yeah, you notice it immediately. And in the big companies, they've got dedicated firewalls. They've got layered security. They've got different things where all of the traffic routes around. And in your small office, this has to do everything. It's your Wi-Fi, your security, your parental controls, your guest networks, and VPN duties, and so much more. And a lot of people will go on out and they say, I'm going to go the cheap route. I'm just going to get this cheap router. It is $50. It's $70. It's going to do just fine. And for residential folks, yeah, it's fine for casual browsing. But once you start racking up all of the different things that are going to just beat it up. The video meetings, the cloud backups, the smart devices, the business tools, all of this, they start to buckle under the load. A good router, spending a bit more on the money, basically improves more than speed. It improves the stability. It reduces those mysterious dropouts that seem to happen at the worst possible moment. And security is another big piece. Modern routers include built-in firewalls, intrusion detection, and automatic updates. But you have to turn these features on. You have to keep the firmware current. You have to keep going with this. You can't just set it up and forget it. And many small businesses don't realize that that old $70, $100 router that's sitting over there is actually one of the most common entry points for cyber attacks. And I'm not being dramatic here. It's just neglected equipment that was great 5 years ago, 10 years ago, but it's doing its best with old instruction sets. And then we get into other areas. There's Wi-Fi coverage. In a home office, the signal has to fight through walls, the appliances, and sometimes even the neighbor's network, where they've got a better router, they've got better throughput, they've got better speeds going on over there. But those better speeds and all of that are impacting your speed, your Wi-Fi within your own network. So upgrading that router or installing something like a mesh system can turn your frustrating workspace in your small environment into a much smoother place. For small teams, that router also controls how your devices, all of the different laptops and desktops, how they share files and the printers and storage. And when your network is healthy, all of this collaboration can feel effortless. Otherwise, it's going to feel harder than it should. And yes, here's another indicator for you. If your router needs a reboot, we'll say every day or every couple of days, that's not normal. This is a sign that it's time to go on out and do an upgrade. It's not something you should have as just a ritual in your work day. Oh, hey, we got to reboot the router again today. It's about lunchtime. Yeah, go figure. The nice thing is a lot of these modern routers are far easier to manage than they used to be. They've got all kinds of pop-up dashboards and simple setup tools that make it possible for a lot of non-techie folks to really keep things running smoothly. You know, you can have a professional come in, install it, set it up, make sure you've got the right stuff going, but they should also spend about 20 minutes, half an hour, giving you kind of a run through of how it works, and it should be something that you pick up right away. They should be able to explain out just a few things for you, but most of these now, like a lot of technology, should be a matter of you set it up, you do a little bit of training, and then you move on. That's a lot of what I've done in more of my recent years. And when I say recent years, the last 15 or so, I believe in empowering people, giving them the knowledge to at least do some of these things on their own. And this is really key here for everyone, home office or small to medium-sized businesses. The router is the quiet backbone of the modern workspace. When it's strong, everything else feels easier. So while it may look like that box is just another box with blinking lights, it's actually the foundation of your digital environment, and it deserves a little bit more attention and a little bit more money, a little bit more budget than it usually gets. This is Benjamin Rockwell. You're listening to Computer Talk Radio. I'll be back with more in just a moment. Years ago, I found a web hosting company that fit my needs as a computer nerd, as a radio show host, and, well, a normal person. Recently, though, it became clear to me that it was time to upgrade. I had a choice between my old plan and the new one at 7 times the cost. It was that awkward point where I could choose between a sip of water or being dunked in a pool. I searched around, comparing the many options for someone like me. After looking for 3 weeks, there it was, SiteGround. In proper fashion, I tested their customer service, their knowledge, and their care, their willingness to do things the right way. The SiteGround salesman made sure that I didn't overbuy and get a 50-gallon bucket when all I needed was a 1 gallon bucket. The folks at SiteGround know WordPress, Joomla, and more. SiteGround.com, S-I-T-E, ground.com, for your web hosting needs. SiteGround. David asks, why do I keep getting asked to accept push notifications from websites? Should I ever say yes? And push notifications are useful, but only in the right context. You see, these push notifications allow websites to send you updates. And for some of these, that even applies when you're not actively visiting them, like they'll send you a news alert or a sale reminder or a shipping update. And for time-sensitive information, breaking news, weather warnings, or package out for delivery, this is something that can be helpful. Most sites, by the way, I should note, most sites do not do it across all of your web surfing. They only cover when you're on their website. And some of these different services use this information very well. They're going to give you opt-in alerts for things that you care about. But the way they ask for permission at times can be rather annoying. Hey, you just arrived here on my website, and before you even take a look at anything, we want to send you notifications in perpetuity for everything that we decide is important to you. And that's like just someone coming up. They ring your doorbell to ask you if they can ring your doorbell later every day for selling you something that you don't want in the first place. And I will tell you, this is my personal preference. I select no on most of these. Most of the different uses for push notifications that I've seen have been for sales and promotions and things like that, not actual valuable updates that I need in my life. And when we go down these roads, when we start to say yes to all of this, it's really easy to forget which sites that we've allowed. And that noise adds up fast in a world which is already very noisy. Yes, you can go into your browser and you can select which places get to give you push notifications, and they can basically be deleted from there, and you solve that problem rather quick. But that is an additional action that you have to take. And I don't like those actions. I don't want to have to deal with some shady site that's going to abuse this idea, and it's going to start sending me spammy or even malicious content through their own push channels. This is something that we should address, and we should avoid all of this clutter in the first place. We can't undo all of this. We can't just say nobody should ever be able to send push notifications to anybody unless there's all of these requirements are met or whatever. And yes, I expect that governments, especially Europe, are going to take measures forward to enable us to get valuable push notifications, but to squelch all the rest. So, unless you really trust the site and you want their updates, my best response to you and everybody else is to say, no, thank you. This is Benjamin Rockwell. You're listening to Computer Talk Radio. We'll catch you next week.
Coming up next is a really funny guy. You all know him. Let's give it up for Alonzo Bowden. Alonzo!
So my uncle calls and he says he's dizzy and he's losing his balance. I'm like, Unc, you want me to take you to a doctor? He's like, no, I'm going to look up the symptoms. I said, your symptoms are you're dizzy and you're losing your balance. So he said, I can't get on the internet because my arm is numb. I said, well, use your good arm and dial 911. Stroke's no joke. If you or someone you love is showing symptoms of stroke, don't call family. Don't dial a friend. Don't wait, because it might be too late.
dial 911. Time lost is brain lost. Seriously, dial 911.
Learn all the symptoms of a stroke at StrokesNoJoke.org. That's StrokesNoJoke.org. A public service announcement brought to you by the American Stroke Association and the Ad Council.